Francisco, care continuation of the council case.
Thank you, good morning. So we have Mr. Place this morning. We are going to start with his evidence on submissions on the text of the general industrial zone. Mr. Place has filed three statements of evidence, a Section 42A report dated 18 March and two rebuttal statements dated 12 June and 19 June. We've handed up a highlights summary. I will ask Mr. Place to read paragraphs 1 through 7, which relate to the text. And then we will take a very brief adjournment and get the panel set up for the rezonings. I do just note there are a number of submissions made that some are specific to text, but some relate to a specific rezoning as well, so we'll just have to manage that this morning as we go. Over to you, Mr. Place.
Good morning. The general industrial zone provides a planning framework to manage the district's finite land resource available for the establishment, operation and long-term viability of industrial and service activities. These activities play a key role in supporting the district's industrial economy, which is growing rapidly at a faster rate than any other part of the district's economy. The industrial economy therefore offers the district's people and communities a pathway to achieve economic well-being. As such, it is important that the ability of industrially zoned land to sustain activities involved in the industrial economy be recognised and provided for. The district's industrially zoned land and those activities that rely on space within it face considerable pressure from activities which do not comprise the industrial economy. It is the overall intent of Chapter 18A to exclude activities from the general industrial zone which do not form part of or directly support the district's industrial economy. Taking into account the present understanding of the district's industrial economy, the value it provides, the pressure it faces, and the strong direction provided in Strategic Policy 3.3.8, the general industrial zone identifies a number of prohibited activities, including office, commercial, and retail activities that are not ancillary to industrial or service activities. It is acknowledged that a number of existing office, commercial, and retail activities are present within the general industrial zone. Its provisions do not apply retrospectively, however, and these existing activities will be able to continue through the support of existing use rights or by way of an approved resource consent. The general industrial zone enables other non-industrial and service activities which support the district's industrial economy as permitted activities. In particular, those office, commercial and retail activities which are ancillary to industrial or service activities. Consenting pathways are provided within Chapter 18A for ancillary activities that differ in scale and intensity to those directly anticipated within the zone. I have recommended an amendment to the activity status for trade suppliers from prohibited to fully discretionary. This recognises that trade suppliers play a role in supporting the industrial economy. The general industrial zone also seeks to manage the type of amenity experienced within the zone, noting that it is a critical urban location intended to foster economic activity, employment and trade. It also seeks to manage the type of effects that activities within the zone may have on other sites outside of its boundaries, recognising that the zone is located in close proximity to other zones in which industrial and service activities and their associated effects are not commonly anticipated. This review does not attempt to identify substantial new areas of land to be included within the general industrial zone. It primarily relates to land currently located within the operative suite of industrial zones. The review has identified or zoned sufficient capacity to provide for industrial development over the short and medium term, and therefore meets the expectation of the National Policy Statement on Urban Development Capacity. The Council is currently developing its future development strategy in close partnership with key parties, including central government agencies, iwi and the district's communities. The future development strategy development process will enable a more holistic and future-focused approach to the identification of locations for long-term urban development within the district. it would not be desirable for the current review process to preempt the identification of land for long-term development capacity, as it may undermine significant cooperative effort associated with the future development strategy development process. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Place. Mr. Hill, if you'd like to.
Thank you. Mr. Robinson, Mr. Place, can I start at the raw end, and I might just work back up a little bit. So the prohibited activity status I'm going to focus on to start off with, and you pointed out in your statements and in your summary that there are existing activities which would otherwise now be prohibited activities if this came through. Do you, and I'm thinking of this in section 32 in cost terms, do you have any idea of the scale or number of premises or activities which would, which are now existing but would then be prohibited but would then need to exist on existing use rights or their consents? I'm just trying to get an idea of the scale.
Sure. In my section 32 report, I do discuss in quite a bit of detail the ground truthing exercise that was undertaken. And in that part of my section 32 report, I identify percentages of activities that might, well, that aren't essentially form part of our industrial economy, so they aren't industrial service activities. So that would, and I can't remember the percentage figures.
I've read it some time ago. So
yeah, sure. So I can, if
no, it's fine. We can go back. I think
sure.
Do record it there. Yep. But can you give me? Can you recall the sort of percentage? I mean, what are we talking?
So in Glenda Drive, we're looking at sort of around less than 50% would be fall into that non-industrial and service activity type of activities.
My recollection is that it's 40-something, though.
Yeah, correct. Yep. I think it's about 40, somewhere between 42 or 47, something like that. But they wouldn't be prohibited immediately. Obviously, they do, as we've talked about, and no doubt we'll talk about more, they do, will be able to continue.
I just might want to pick up on that point. And again, and Ms. Hampston sort of supports that approach in terms of the way that this zone is set up, that it's intended to be tight and it's intended to be used for the purpose, the very clear purpose for which you're set out. If I go back up to the objectives and policies, and they are very directly, which they need to be in terms of that prohibited activity status, what's your view, or have you turned your mind to whether you think those objectives and policies, particularly those ones which sort of avoid those activities, would enable a good basis for assessing non-complying activities if the prohibited activity status can seem to be too strict and they were specified as non-complying activities? And are you confident that the way you've expressed those would allow an appropriate assessment to determine the 104 D test and then if it, the effects were something?
Are you suggesting if the activities were non-complying?
So what I'm really asking, and I'm sure that's what we're going to get from a number of submitters, they're saying this is too strict and we need to look at some alternative. Clearly stepping back could be discretionary, it could be non-compliant. So my question to you is, would you be confident that the objectives and policies are framed in a way that would enable a proper assessment and a clear assessment giving a clear direction on the compatibility or non-compatibility of these activities? Because the way some of the objectives in there are framed, they're talking about those which are non-compatible and don't displace. Someone might want to argue that our case doesn't do that.
Well, so I've tried to frame the suite of objectives and policies in a way that clearly separates what is anticipated and what isn't anticipated. So the first objective and the suite of policies talk about what is anticipated within the zone, and that very clearly sets up out the intent of the zone and what it's meant to provide for. The second suite of policies and its associated objectives, I believe, is quite clear in outlining. And in fact, at 18A221, sets out a range of activities that are to be avoided. So I believe it is quite clear in that respect.
I might have not made my question clear enough. I think the way that the objectives, most of them are framed, they're very directive. Because they need to be if you want to use those to support that prohibited activity status. I suppose the question I was asking, and I'm not sure, you know, thinking this is where a consenting type question, whether if those prohibited activities were, or some of them, were non-complying, and again,
sure.
I'm not suggesting they should be,
yep.
I'm just really trying to understand from you whether you think the way that you have drafted
okay.
those executive policies would still provide a good basis for an assessment of
yep.
those activities as non-compliant
yeah.
activities if that's where it ended up.
Sure.
Or is it your view that the prohibitive status is absolutely necessary?
If the other way to look at it is, would non-complying activity status associated with these objectives and policies result in most applications being refused?
Thank you. That's much more direct.
Yeah. I believe so. And that is my intent. That is the intent of Chapter 18A. And in regard to the application of a non-compliant activity status, it doesn't provide the same level of certainty that a prohibited activity status does. And my understanding for a non-compliant activity is that there are circumstances in which the activities that are non-compliant wouldn't challenge or oppose the objectives and policies or those which sit in the higher order chapters of the plan. I'm not sure that there are any circumstances in which those activities would be appropriate and wouldn't challenge the objectives and policies either in the chapter or in the higher order chapters. Non-compliant activities are regularly granted. In fact, the majority of them are. And it doesn't provide the same level of certainty that a prohibited activity status does. And I would argue that it also isn't consistent with that. That 338.
I think you're right, that prohibited activity status creates a very certain outcome.
Yep.
You can't even apply for them. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's input for now.
Commissioner McLeod.
Mr. Police, thank you for turning up and for your good efforts. I've got a question with you, Evidence in Chief, just 534. Which is, you discuss an alternative option involving the establishment of a new activity rule table 18A4, which sets the status of office, commercial, and retail activities lawfully established within. Is that still your thought process?
Yeah, so I still am of the view that. Although that's an option, and I was keen to explore the options, and I think I have set out quite a detailed assessment of the ability for the plan or otherwise to effectively sort of set out a mechanism in the alternative to a prohibited activity status, and I still am of the view that the prohibited activity status is the most efficient and effective mechanism.
Just as a small aside, I was kind of amused. The definition of trade suppliers is video and DVD hire.
Yeah.
Slowly dropping the belief. It's just I was quite amused by that, as you said.
Yeah.
And just with regard to those definitions of trade suppliers and the new policy, which includes definitions, it's one of the hazards you have when you define a set of, and I was just wondering, one of the groups that's specifically recognised is marine suppliers, for example.
Mm.
So how do, if you look at the table you've got at 570 of your, the recognise, and this is in the GIS zone, is recognising that provide for trade suppliers within the zone only where the following can be demonstrated, and there's ABC.
Mm.
And I was just wondering how does, for example, marine suppliers fit into that, and therefore, by definition, be excluded,
yeah.
even though there are, and was that your intent? Do you understand the question?
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
Yes. So, the thrust of the proposed recognise and provide for trade suppliers policy is really to ensure that it's not a retail destination. And if it would depend if the marine supplier was supplying to significantly a significant amount of its business was to non-businesses, I guess, then it wouldn't meet that test, in my view. However, I think marine suppliers, I mean, I'm not going to say I'm hugely familiar with the specific activity, and I imagine it has a wide spectrum of businesses that might fall within that, but if you're a marine supplier, there's a high likelihood that you will be supplying other businesses, or at least you might be involved in, you might actually fall within a service activity. In fact, in some instances, and if you are servicing boats as well, if there's a component to that, so it's a little bit more nuanced, I guess, but it depends whether it's that retail component or the wholesaling component. I think there would be scope for it to fall within it.
Yes. And so take, for example, if someone like a marine supplier came out of this particular crisis we're in, and a resounding business wanted to extend, so they're looking to apply to maybe take over a larger area, a larger business. How does that fit into the JIS zone, if you understand where I'm coming from? So they're going to upgrade to a new premises.
Sure.
So, and it's just that a trade supplier moving to a larger premises and then being non-compliant. How do you envisage that sort of scenario?
Being prohibited, do you mean, or non-compliant? If it was an existing trade supplier that was already predominantly involved in wholesaling or non-retail related activities to the public, then it would be able to expand or continue or move to a new location which was bigger and possibly more suitable to its particular needs. If it was trade supply that was predominantly involved in wholesaling previously and was moving to a activity which was more retail based, then it would be challenged by the two policies that I've proposed, and I think that's appropriate given the intent of the zone and the pressures that it faces.
And there was, in your evidence in chief again at 7.9, as you referred to 18A46, which is buildings within the out of control boundary, and based on the 2037 noise contours, I was just wondering, and I'm not sure if it made the actual chapter. Just wondering if in which is page 56 of your evidence in chief, I was just wondering what the 2037 noise contours were. 2037?
On page 56 of my section 42A report.
Yes, and there's a table.
Yep.
Which refers to a part of the general industrial chapter, and it's underlined as there's some strikeouts and some underlines that are inserted, and it's got shall be designed to achieve an indoor sound level and any critical listening environment based on the 2037 noise contours.
Oh, sure.
And I'm just not sure what those are. Apologies.
Yes, those was part of the plan change, which set up the noise contours and was advocated by the Queensland Airport Corporation in their submission, and I have adopted that recommendation in large part, I believe. So that's effectively consistent, as far as I'm aware, with the other zones that apply controls in relation to noise. But in terms of the exact meaning of it, I'm sorry, I'm not able to give you a specific answer other than it's consistent with what the Airport Corporation requested and is in other parts of the plan. I imagine it would be designation, but I can't, yeah.
Is the key question, they're not an extension of the existing noise contours?
I'm just really nervous about the noise contours.
I can confirm they won't be, and if they are, that needs to be changed. But I was just asking Mr. Place, are they the contours in the designation or are they shown on the plan maps? But we can just check and confirm that for you.
If you remind that would be sensational.
I think they're on the plan maps.
Just across the page on 713 of the last sentence is, I therefore reject this submission point be rejected. Does that mean it's accepted?
And what paragraph, sorry?
Paragraph 713, the last sentence. I therefore reject this submission point be rejected.
Too many rejections.
Does that mean that it's accepted?
Paragraph, what was it again, sorry? I couldn't hear you.
713.
The last sentence.
Oh, and yeah, that was seems to be highlighted. I think that might be a draft correcting.
That's
yeah,
absolutely. It was highlighted, but it wasn't me, and I thought
it made it through the review process. Unfortunately,
it was definitely rejected.
Yeah,
and that's it for me for the moment.
Thank you. I just want to touch on, you made a comment just before that most non-complying activities are a majority of non-complying activities are approved. Is that a correct application of the rules, or shouldn't non-complying activities be the exception, not the majority?
Yeah, that is correct, although it would appear that the majority are granted.
Okay, so
they are meant to be certainly an exception and which doesn't challenge or oppose the objection policy.
Yep. So, okay, it's an interesting reflection, I think, on the administration of the rules, and I think we need to be very careful with that. Firstly, I want to touch on the boundary, how we deal with boundaries of an industrial area or precinct. And I've got, if we could just look at those area in Wanaka. Can you just sort of describe why you've chosen the boundaries of the proposed industrial areas as what they are? I suppose starting at Gordon Road and maybe going through Tussock Rise and then down to Enterprise Drive and stuff.
Sure. Would you be able to bring up the Wanaka on the screen? Sorry, do you know where it is, or I can help? Might be of assistance.
Is it fair to say that we generally like to have create some sort of buffer or separation from industrial areas to residential activities and to mixed business use, more sensitive environments? Is that part of the intent, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, to answer the first part of your question was the location of the boundaries in Wanaka specifically.
Yep.
In the large part, it is based on the operative district plan, industrial A, industrial and industrial B zones, and obviously in response up the area to the south of the active sport recreation zone is new and creates quite a sort of cohesive zoning arrangement in that location in my view. But the in respect to the application of buffers, I guess our industrial zones are a little bit unique in that they have sort of been around for a wee while, and they are generally surrounded by other zones. I think a buffer is appropriate in some circumstances. However, I don't think it's appropriate in all circumstances, and there is an intent in the chapter to ensure that where there isn't a buffer or a specific, for example, building restriction area, I think the zone can act in a way that ensures that the amenity of adjoining zones isn't adversely affected, which is the fourth objective in its policies. That's the intent.
So just to run through that, so on the southern side of Tussock Rise, we have a BRA that I understand is also subject to a significant mounding that bunding or separation, is that's correct?
That's built into the variation to chapter 27.
So that provides a visual and acoustic barrier to the residential area on the other side?
Yeah, it does. It does act in a number of ways, including visual and just general physical separation.
And if we go down to Enterprise Drive, there's a similar arrangement. There's a large BRA that provides a buffer to the adjoining, plan change 34.
Anyway. That sounds right.
And the proposed area on the other side of the road, you know, clearly we've got Wastebusters, we've got a substation. It doesn't directly adjoin, apart from that narrow strip up the end of the reserve area, it doesn't directly adjoin any residential areas, that's correct?
That's right. So there's a number of zones that surround the general industrial zone in that location, and they enable other types of activities at various densities.
Yep. And obviously the position of council now is that the industrial zone don't occur on the three parks side, so there's no adjoining, and then Ballantyne Road provides the boundary to the industrial, and then the activities at Gordon Road. So what I'm just trying to paint a picture is it's sort of contained in terms of its boundaries.
Yes,
and that's quite a useful approach.
I think so, yeah, and particularly in Wanaka with those BRAs and the Ballantyne Road and then Riverbank Road, I believe it is, running south and north. It'll be
okay. That's fine. Can you... The shift... when taking from the operative district plan, Industrial A and Industrial B, and going to a single general industrial, I made the point the other day that the planning standards actually provide for three levels of industrial land, light industrial, heavy industrial, which was sort of more in line with, I suppose, the operative A and B provisions. Do you think there's a risk that we haven't defined those categories, haven't slotted them into the right space?
No, I think they are in the correct... I think the general industrial zone, as described in the National Planning Standards, is the most appropriate. The National Planning Standards set out a very brief description of the different possible zones, and if you look at what light industrial is, it talks about... areas used predominantly for a range of industrial activities and associated activities with adverse effects that are reasonable to residential activities sensitive to these effects. It suggests that there's residential activities within the zone that would be appropriate for the effects of industrial and service activities, which I don't support.
But if we to look at comparing that against the industrial A provisions and, you know, particularly what's been established in Gordon Road, isn't that exactly what's been established? That a mix of residential and light industrial activities?
There's not a lot of residential activities within the zone.
I don't know the address, but in Gordon Road there's a significant development where there's physios and other things with accommodation upstairs, and there's the CrossFit place in Gordon Road has an apartment upstairs. There are a significant number of them that have accommodation.
Sure. Yeah, and in regards to that, man, it's quite an interesting one, because in response to Mr. Devlin's evidence on Tussock Rise, I actually respond to, and I don't want to move into the rezonings, obviously, but it is relevant to the point that you raise in regards to these comprehensive type developments that appear on the surface to have residential or other uses at first floor level and then at ground floor an industrial or service activity. And I would really caution the perception of those as being not well thought out or planned for the context in which they're in. So in that particular example that I mentioned just before, and I'm not sure exactly with your example that you might, I think, talking about on the northern side, but there are a lot of circumstances in which the consents have been granted with custodial units at the top, which are specifically tied to an industrial use at the bottom. They've had no complaint covenants attached to them on the basis that they are specifically attached to an industrial service use at the bottom. So,
I suppose I'm trying to view it more from the character that has been established, and I'll go on to sort of explore that a little bit. The what comes first, the character or the zoning? So does the zoning define the character, or does the character define the environment?
Well, are you referring to the mix of activities that are present within the zone, I guess?
Yeah. I suppose what I'm trying to get at is it possible to change an existing character by changing the zoning and the policy? If the existing character is different to...
Well, I guess the zone isn't trying to change the existing character. And I would argue that in most cases, the character of the zone is generally consistent with the intent of the zone. And the zone, the general industrial zone, as proposed, isn't directly trying to change the character. It is trying to ensure that the zone is a viable location for the establishment, growth and operation of industrial and service activities.
Isn't the changing of the permitted activities and indeed prohibiting activities that were otherwise allowed for or otherwise established, isn't that changing the character? Attempting to change the character.
Yeah. Over time, it may result in a decrease in the number of office, commercial and retail activities, which I don't think is undesirable.
So if I take that to the extreme, if you took an urban environment and you applied a rural zone over it, would you be able to change the character of that environment over time? Back to be in line with the policies that you're promoting?
Well, it's unlikely, given that... Yeah,
which is sort of what I'm getting at. Is it actually possible to wind back a character that's been established by, I would have thought that the zonings typically flow in one direction, not the other. You go from being a, and I think of the example that there's certainly examples of rural environments where it has been heavily argued that the character has been changed to such a point that it is no longer rural in character.
Mm.
And I have some concern that that would be the case here, that if you tried to say someone applied for a non-complying activity for a retail activity or a residential activity, and people would go, and you'd argue that it was against the policies and objectives, but someone would then argue that it's the character is already established, and there'd be a conflict there.
I'm sorry, Commissioner, I'm not sure what the question is. I wonder if we could...
Okay.
Focus
sorry,
on that,
I appreciate that, sorry. My point is there difficulty in prohibiting activities that are already established in the zone, and does that create a difficulty in administering the plan moving forward?
No, I don't think it does. I think in terms of the character of the zone, I do believe it is industrial in character, predominantly industrial in character.
Okay.
And I think the proposed... The zone, as I've proposed it, will actually produce a much more efficient and effective administration process in terms of the land use management in the zone.
Okay, and I've just got one more theme to discuss, is the one of existing use rights. You've talked about how an activity that was established could continue to occur. As I understand it, the existing use rights test is quite specific in that it has to have be demonstrated to have continued, and it has to have, you know, it has to be of an equivalent scale, and has to. So does that create some problems in if there's a break in an activity? So a particular building was established for an activity, and then, you know, COVID-19 comes along, that activity shuts down for 2 years. Someone comes back and goes, I'd like to re-establish that activity, but it's suddenly prohibited.
Mm-hmm.
Does that run into some problems?
You're right.
In re-establishing a similar activity?
The tests of Section 10 are quite clear. And it would cause them problems if they shut down for the period that Section 10 sets out. However, I think it would be incredibly difficult at this point in time to suggest that COVID-19 would result in businesses struggling to meet that test. I think that would be quite a sort of crystal ball gazing exercise when you're uncertain of the extent to which COVID-19 would impact those businesses. And as I understand it, I'll leave it there.
Okay, and I suppose...
Ms. Hanson has obviously talked to that point in regard to COVID-19 as well, and I would certainly endorse that in terms of the application.
That was just an example of a disruption, I suppose, but
sure.
Which I suppose is just one, leaves to one final question is, would you suggest of any way to protect the existing activities without having to rely on existing use rights in moving forward with these change of provisions?
Yes, so I did set out, as I've talked to previously, in my Section 42A report, I did talk in some detail, because I believed it did require a properly set out assessment of potential options for not relying on Section 10 or existing resource consents. And I set out the pros and cons of those in my Section 42A report. I did also invite submitters to build on those, but none from the evidence that was received from submitters, no one did build on that or further discuss the alternative options that I had set out in my Section 42A report. So in the absence of any further information, I do believe that the prohibited activity status and relying on the established mechanism of Section 10 would be most effective.
Place, can I just expand on that point that you just had? It occurred to me that we're now reading from the discussion you just talked about. 5.34 of your 42A report, talking about effectively a prohibited activity, all that parallels Section 10, perhaps without, don't pick up the Commissioner's point, without the break in transmission that Section 10 has, requirement for continuous or virtually continuous use. It occurred to me that the problem with prohibited activity is that you're going to set up a platform for existing environment arguments to edge out from the permitted activity, and therefore that perhaps the answer might be an RDA.
A restricted discretionary activity
for continuation and expansion of existing lawfully established operations.
In terms of the expansion, I wouldn't agree that that's what the intent of the zone is. In terms of us, it would generally be inconsistent with what the zone is trying to achieve, and an RDA activity that would, and also be inconsistent with the direction Chapter 3. In terms of it being a mechanism to enable the continuation, or possibly, it would be a very difficult, I think it's difficult to say right now at this point in time, because in terms of the scale of the expansion, it would be generally inconsistent with the chapter. I think it would just be clearer to not enable the expansion in the that would need a consent. I think it should rely on the Section 10 or Section 127 in terms of resource consent. I think we just have to be very careful with providing a mechanism for expansion of those activities within the zone. There may be scope to do it, but there is a risk, in my view, that we start to move away from what the intent of the zone is, and also start to possibly result in the introduction of reverse sensitivity effects that might not have been present with the existing activity in question.
Mr. Robinson might ask you a follow-up question, but do you want to answer his question? There was two parts. There was an RDA for alterations to an existing consent and the expansion concept, and he asked whether RDA might be appropriate. Do you want to answer that question as well? So if it was an activity that wasn't, a rule that wasn't dealing with expansion, with an RDA?
If it was an RDA activity which just dealt with the existing activity to establish its rights, is that what your question is?
Is Scott, first, there are two arms to Section 10.
Sure.
And that's, I think, the big issue that the submitters are talking about is be solely reliant on Section 10 and the conditions that go with it.
Yeah.
And then have an out to continue for continuation. As say, expansion is a different issue. I understand your point, but expansion, how do you write a rule or policies, for instance, around the substantially similar component of Section 10? But let's just talk about continuation.
Sure. You're right. I do talk to that I believe in, appears to be 5.35 of my section 44 report. And if there was an efficient and effective mechanism that we could put in the plan to, that wouldn't conflict with the tests of section 10 and existing resource consents and their ability.
I think that if someone has an existing resource consent, then they're fine.
Yeah.
If they have established lawfully pursuant to permitted activity rules in the past.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, if there could a rule, if a rule could be drafted in a way that, that it would not cut across section 10, then I would not, I guess, be uncomfortable for the existing activities. But as you've set out just before, the expansion side of things gets a bit more murky. And
how much have you tried to formulate such a rule? I mean, because you've mentioned Hamilton City here.
Yeah.
I know Christchurch had an attempt at it.
Yeah.
In one of those zones where it was trying to claw back, probably may well not have been effective, but I mean, there'll be other examples. Have you tried?
Yes, I have.
In
the drafting stages.
Yes.
Yes.
To formulate a rule.
Mm.
I mean, to try and deal with these issues for existing activities.
Yes. I have done. I did draft a rule based on when I was playing around with the submissions and response with the chapter and response to submissions. I did in drafting that reflect on the Hamilton example that I mentioned, setting out a specific date at which the activity might be otherwise treated under
the date as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The date approach. Yeah.
20th of March 2020 would seem to be an auspicious day.
Yeah, so I guess yes is the answer, that I have had a go.
And what did you find the problems with efficient implementation were in all cases insurmountable?
I think I just thought that the Section 10 framework would be an established framework that people could rely on. And
I mean, it is very difficult to rely on. I mean,
yeah.
No one wants to go there.
Just reflect on where I got to with that. I believe I talked to it in my Section 42 report.
About 5.35 or 4 or something. 5.34 is where you mentioned Hamilton.
Mr. Place has probably been a bit kinder not wanting to put me under the bus here, but I did see some drafting that Mr. Place did, and there were some. It's really difficult. So we were looking at a permitted activity to start with, and it's really hard to draft something which is certain. And so Mr. Place tried around a permitted activity rule, but I wasn't comfortable with it from a legal perspective, which is, I guess, one of the reasons why we couldn't come up with something. So you can pass the buck to me there. We have looked at drafting. We then sort of turned a bit later in the piece to the RDA option. I think there's more potential there to be able to draft something that will work, but it's still really difficult to try and replicate Section 10 across into a rule without creating more issues. And you've referred to the Christchurch attempts, which I'm aware of, and I was thinking about that when I was reviewing Mr. Place's
efforts
around
this. I
think,
as the Chair said, it's not necessary to replicate all of Section 10. I suppose my question on this topic was going to be, is it really a policy position of the zone to actually get rid of all these activities in the long run?
No.
To drive them out?
No, it's not a policy position.
No. I mean, you're not intending that over time you want them to go, and so that it's more of a pure industrial and service.
That's right, and I've responded to that very matter, that very term, pure industrial zone, in response to other
Well, it would seem to leave these activities as a prohibited status without any, and only relying on their section 10 existing use rights is, I mean, it does seem quite harsh if that's not the position to get rid of them.
Yes, I understand.
However,
so if I may, going back to that point I opened with, that a non-complying activity should be the exception. So, I mean, a prohibited status is quite a hard line, whereas a non-complying activity status is still a hard threshold for them to meet, but it still leaves the door open for it. And so, anyway, I'll just let you know.
On that score, please, you said in response to Commissioner Smith's query, I think that, paraphrasing it as I wrote it down, yes, in theory, non-complying activity status should be the exception, but it hasn't worked out like that. Is that because the ODP objectives and policies are not sufficiently directive as to the outcomes they're seeking, or alternatively, is it a failure of administration of the rule, or both?
Well, the ODP rules, I don't think, in their actual activity statuses, weren't necessarily strong enough either. But in terms of the administration, I was doing a bit of reading around non-compliant activities and, you know, sort of how it's an awkward interplay between prohibited and discretionary. And I think the administration side of things is just reflective of that awkward interaction, and it's obviously not meant to be a quasi or a proxy prohibited activity status, so it's not going to implement an exclude or an avoid policy. So I guess from an administrative perspective, it's going to be implemented, it's going to be provided for, and yeah, that's been shown through the stats in terms of how many of them are granted.
I want to talk to you a bit more about the non-complying issue, and then we'll talk about your Section 42A report, and you talk about the strategic policies at 3.3.8. But we'll start with the non-complying activities. I have to say I've struggled with some of the answers you've given. You've been led a bit by other panellists, but I've been pretty worried at the prospect of practitioners or decision makers predetermining whether an application for consent might be good or not just because of its activity status. I'd have to ask you to rethink the basis for your view that non-complying activities should somehow be an exception to a rule. Does the Act say that when it describes different activity status?
Well, 104D talks about how it should not be contrary.
Yeah, but that doesn't say they shouldn't happen or shouldn't be granted. It's just a procedural test they have to pass, isn't it?
That's correct.
Are you aware of the council appealing any of the non-complying activity decisions it's made that you think perhaps were wrong or problematic? Has it ever actually asked itself the question that it may have made an error? Do you know?
How do you mean, sorry, appealing its own decision?
Well, if the council's granted non-complying activity applications that maybe it shouldn't have, has it ever appealed itself? Councils do that from time to time.
No, I'm not aware of that.
Famous law.
Yeah. Where I'm going is it's easy for any one of us to drive around some of these places and say that's not what we thought should have happened, but that's not relevant, is it? But the question is whether or not there's actually been some problem with the administration of the previous plan, that the council just couldn't stop. That's effectively one plank of the argument for prohibited activity status. But it may well be that those consents were properly granted because that's just the way the plan was written. Or it could be the council just didn't do a very good job. We don't know because we've been given no evidence. And so it's a pretty high ask to take away any opportunity for a consent for people in the future on the what could be a very subjective 2020 casting back in history buyer's remorse. Is that a fair suggestion of what might be happening? Or do you have evidence such as decisions written by the council that said, gosh, we really wish we could refuse this, but we feel forced into it? Do you have any resource consent decisions like that? Or do they all say, this is fine?
I don't think any resource consent decision is going to say that it was forced into making a decision.
Well, that's part of your argument, that the council can't stop non-complying activities. So I'm asking, do you have any actual evidence of that?
The significant amount of non-compliant activities that have been granted.
But why is that a bad thing? If the plan didn't say they shouldn't be granted, the council has a series of decisions and each one says it's been properly considered and passed the tests and has merited the granting of consent. Where's the evidence that that's an actual defect in the plan? I think what it comes back to is the assumption you're making that non-complying activities shouldn't be granted. And I think that's a very dangerous assumption to make.
Say that again, sorry. My assumption is that
you've put to me that there's an evidence of a problem because lots of non-complying activity applications have been granted consent. And I'm putting back to you the fact that non-complying activities might get granted consent isn't indicative of a problem. It might just mean that each one merited the granting of consent based on the relevant test. So what I'm looking for is actual evidence that non-complying activities can't be relied on.
Well, in terms of, so taking it back a step to the application of non-compliant activities and prohibited activities, especially to office, commercial and retail, as I've said out before, the non-compliant activities should only be an exception.
Does the district plan have a policy that says that? And does the RMA have a section that says that? Because I'm not aware of any section that says how the council should approach RDAs or discretionaries. It shouldn't say permitted activities are good children and non-complying activities are naughty children. They're just activity status that have a different process attached to them. So I'm asking, I understand your view and I'm not attacking that. I'm asking if you can actually show some corroboration of where your view's coming from.
Yeah, so non-compliant activity status is regularly applied to the type of activities that are certainly not those that a council or another authority would regularly seek to be approved within a zone.
Mm.
The non-compliant activity status doesn't provide the level of certainty that I'm trying to achieve with Chapter 18A.
Going forward, yep.
And I am not of the view that there are any circumstances in which, special circumstances, in which a new office, commercial or retail activity, which isn't ancillary, should be provided for within the zone. The exceptions are provided for within the Chapter 18A through the ancillary activities, being that is an appropriate commercial, office or retail activity within the zone, because it's supporting an industrial service activity.
Yes, now I'm not asking you to explain what's proposed, I understand that.
Yep.
What I'm trying to prepare myself for is the likely scenario of a submitter later in this process saying just because the council did an absolutely appalling job of administering its last plan, that doesn't mean I shouldn't be allowed to apply for anything. And I'm hoping for some actual evidence rather than a philosophical debate on what we all personally think the plan might mean by different statuses to back that up. Now, if that's what we've got, that's what we've got. So I'm not going to keep on at you about it if you can't provide anything further.
Well, the activity status isn't that I've selected isn't based on the council's performance, really, in granting or otherwise non-complying resource consents. I don't think that really is the best starting point for choosing an activity status, really. The activity status that I've selected is And I would think that in every circumstance and activity status that is selected for in a plan review process is based on the intent of the chapter and commensurate to its effects that are associated with the particular activity.
Mm.
The administration side of things, while relevant, I guess, in terms of thinking about how the plan might be implemented going forward, I guess the administration side of things could change at any point in time based on the planners there or the manager in place and things like that.
So let's circle back to one of the answers you gave Commissioner Hill right at the outset, and he talked to you about non-complying activities. If we put aside the past track record of the previous plan and what the council might not have done or not have done, but looking just at the provisions you've put or proposed that take a very clear view about avoiding certain things, is it your view that just based on that, non-complying activities would still be granted at such a rate that they shouldn't be, that they're not appropriate? So unbundle all the baggage of what you think non-complying activities should or shouldn't do. Just think about the objectives and policies that are proposed right now in the GIZ. If there was a non-complying activity, is it your view that an unacceptable number would just keep getting granted consent?
I believe that there is a degree of uncertainty with it, and that level of uncertainty is not acceptable in my view, based on the significant economic value and that Ms. Hampson has placed on the zone as well in terms of, I believe it just provides that level of uncertainty that if we can remove it from the plan in the first instance, we'll get a much more desirable outcome from a planning perspective.
Let's turn to your 42A report. I'm going to ask you to start at your paragraph 5.7. And that then leads to the quote of our strategic direction policy, 3.3.8. You with me? Yep. And it seems pretty clear. You talked about the panel in stage one at 5.8, 5.9, it's not subject to appeal. We should treat it as fully operative, fully waiting. You've reminded us about what avoid means. That policy 3.3.8, it doesn't say avoid only new non-industrial activities, does it? It doesn't say anything about except existing ones right now. Do you agree that councils are required to observe their own plans, that they're not just for applicants or landowners?
I don't understand, sorry. But the council isn't proposing...
Well, did the council, is it your view that the council needs to comply with its own strategic direction policies when it's, for instance, deciding what zones should be attached to various parcels of land within its district? Or does the council get to not follow the strategic directions when it's deciding what zones should apply to land?
Well, are you suggesting that the avoid approach in 338 means that a general industrial zone isn't appropriate for the land that we're talking about?
I'm going to ask you how you think that policy is going to be implemented on land that already has those activities on it. You've agreed there's no reasonable evidence to suggest they're going to disestablish themselves, and you've agreed in other answers that the council's not seeking to take them away. So, I am interested in your thinking, how you think your own Section 32 analysis has followed this particular strategic direction policy, because it seems to me, 44% of Glenda Drive and substantial percentages of the zone elsewhere don't seem at face value to be doing this policy you've told us is very important and that we should give full weighting to.
Yeah, so, I mean, we have traversed the existing activities and...
But how are they being avoided?
Well, they'll be avoided in the future by
But the policy doesn't say only avoid future or new, does it?
It doesn't say avoid past, though.
It just says avoid all, doesn't it? Isn't there a fund? Part of your answers to the chair about what about allowing some of these uses to expand? You said, well, you can't do that because it won't be meeting what the zone intends. But the zone doesn't intend those uses that are there right now. does it? So why have they been zoned?
Well, so they've been zoned in the way they have done in order to enable the in-situ industrial economy to provide the community its significant benefits that it does.
So you'd agree then on that basis that the policy 3.3.8 that you referred us to isn't being met on those sites that already have those activities that this policy says should be avoided. Is that a fair conclusion? But that there may be other reasons why they should be zoned industrial.
Well, if you were... The review is placing, I guess, a zone over these existing activities. So it's not going to act retrospectively. And I think the way that you're suggesting it should.
I'm asking that, have you considered whether the zone is appropriate on those sites that are undertaking activities that are sought to be prohibited?
I think it is appropriate, yes.
Can you take me to any zone policies or objectives that are in the proposed zone that apply to those sites that could help us understand how it's appropriate?
So, obviously I have provided for trade supplier activities, which is an amendment.
So let's focus on those sites that have not ancillary to industrial activities, specifically let's say the office commercial retail sites, that are still in your view subject to a prohibition, or should be. What makes those, show me how those sites merit the zoning GIZ.
Well, they're inherently, they're located adjacent to, or in some cases on the same site as industrial and service activities, and so therefore they should be subject to the controls of the zone on the basis that the existing industrial and service activities or future industrial service activities should have the, I guess, the protection of that the zone provides for them in terms of the ongoing establishment and growth. So those should be subject to the zone and its provisions in terms of.
But its provisions seek to prohibit them.
That's correct.
How do provisions seeking to prohibit something provide for their ongoing operation?
Well, through those mechanisms that we've talked about through Section 10 and existing resource consents.
Is there a proposed policy that has worked the effect of recognise these existing uses that might otherwise
not
be sought?
It's not common, in my understanding, for zone or for plans to set out policies or objectives that do what you're suggesting.
I think what I'm trying to understand is the fine line between how we can have a place for these otherwise prohibited activities as they are now, but on the basis that any change to them couldn't be possible, which is what you said to the chair about any expansion or change to them.
Yes. Well, so we talked a little while ago about possibly setting up some sort of mechanism in the plan which does recognise these existing activities, and I guess that would be a mechanism to do that, but it should be limited and it should be very direct and it should be very focused.
Is it a case that such a method is, in your view, inherently less appropriate, or is it a case that it's theoretically more appropriate, but to date elusive in terms of how to actually construct such a unicorn provision? What of the two positions would it be fair for me to take from it? I was appreciative of the interruption by counsel to set out some of the difficulties you've encountered. Is it just a case of it's a good idea but too hard, or is it actually just a bad idea?
in terms of the setting up a mechanism for existing activities.
Yeah,
I mean, the problem that I had with it, I guess, is, well, the problem that we decided we're present with it was that it potentially interferes with the RMA approach that's established that needs to be assessed on a case-by-case basis, and it's got quite a lot of case law behind it in terms of the way Section 10 should be implemented, and for the plan to go over top of that presents some risks, but it's a hard thing to balance up. You're right, it is a hard thing to try and say that one approach is better than the other. I just thought that where we got to with the provisions was that the certainty that they currently provide outweighs the possible murky ground of setting out a framework for existing activities. But as I've set out, it's not impossible, as long as it doesn't have the capacity for the establishment of activities or the expansion of them, which would undermine industrial and service activities that are present within the zone.
Okay. Look, the last question I want to ask you is a specific question related to Bush Creek Road and that little club. And I appreciate,
Commissioner, I think that's the...
But then I'm not here for the later on.
Yes, you are. That's the panel that's next.
No, I'm not the RBZ. All right, hold that thought in place. Otherwise, thank you. That's all.
Okay, Mr. Place, I'm going to run through a few questions. And some of them I've already asked to Ms. Hampson, but I just need you to confirm whether you agree with what Ms. Hampson said or not. But I'll probably get into trouble with the chair if we take too long about this, so let's give it a go.
I'm going to take up quite a lot.
I'll have to leave time for him, all right.
Yeah, you can feel free.
Thank you. I asked Ms. Hampson about the strength of the town centre protection policies, and because neither of you in your evidence really emphasised that a lot in terms of the way that the zone doesn't provide for the activities that would otherwise beneficially go into the town centres or the commercial zones or Franklin or wherever. And she said that, yes, that was those provisions that are quite directive, both at the strategic level, were important considerations.
Mm.
What's your view? Do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with what Ms. Hampson said yesterday. And I would comment that my report isn't entirely silent on that matter, but I guess there could be room for expansion on it. And as Ms. Sampson suggested yesterday, the plan is very effective at setting out different zones for particular uses, and there are significant benefits for that activity if it were to be located within the appropriate zone, both in terms of its function but also in terms of the ability for it to service the people or whoever its customers are.
So take offices, for example, which some of which are scattered now throughout the old industrial AIM zones. That would be, and just straight commercial, straight retail, and those would seem to be activities that the policy objectives and policies, the strategic ones, would direct more to the town centres, perhaps to the BMUZ zone, but more to the town centres of Franklin, for the purpose of the vitality and diversity and the benefits to the society of those zones.
Mm-hmm.
So is that something that, although you haven't gone into a lot of detail, you still consider support your approach with the GIZ?
Yeah, certainly. it sets out that specific zones have specific functions, and the town centre and the business mixed use zone and other similar zones which support those sort of multi-use functions are most appropriate for office, commercial and retail activities that are ancillary to industrial and service activities. And I am of the view that the zone approach in Chapter 18A would support the operation of those town centres and other zones and complement their intent in directing those office, commercial and retail activities to those locations.
Well, would you go as far as to say that by not doing that, in other words, if you're opening up the GR, continuing to allow offices and retail to establish more easily in the industrial zones, that that would be contrary to the say the strategic directions for
yes,
town
I believe
centers?
So. There are a number of strategic direction policies and objectives which do talk to that.
I think
and I won't run you through
with Ms. Hampson
yesterday. Yeah, sure. Yeah. So I mean, in particular, it sets out how Queenstown and Wanaka town centres are hubs of the economy, effectively in terms of the visitor experience. And yeah, I won't go into them,
but
absolutely.
338 sits under that in that suite, doesn't it?
338 sits under the suite which talks about town centres and commercial industrial areas. You're correct.
Yes,
so
yes,
those should be
packet,
read together.
Yeah. Mm. All right. Thank you. That's enough on that matter. I also discussed with Ms. Hampson her comment that 50 square metres was a modest level of ground floor area for ancillary offices and retail. Is that something that, and whether there are options of having a combined square metre or percentage, whichever is the lesser type approach, or something that doesn't allow it to skyrocket off into massive numbers if the percentages are, if the site's large. Is that something that you'd be prepared to explore as an alternative, or do you think there are fundamental policy reasons for not going down that track?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that I'd like to discuss in regards to that point. So the scale of ancillary activities was based on, in the first instance, the observations of ancillary activities present within the zone through the ground truthing exercise that was undertaken as part of the Section 32 evaluation. There doesn't appear to be any significant reason to enable or promote larger ancillary office, commercial, or retail activities from that process.
So when Ms. Hampton said it was a modest size, that was just a more general comment that doesn't really relate to the situation in this district? I mean, are you saying that in this district, that's 50 square metres is a perfectly adequate size when you ground truth?
It appears to be the case, that's correct. Yeah. So, I mean, the other point, I guess, is that I refer to Ms. Hampson's work on the industrial economy, which refers to the scale of businesses present, and maybe Ms. Hampson would like to comment on this, but I don't want to. I'm just taking from her work. So the scale of businesses are generally small to medium in our industrial economy. So the area that's proposed in Chapter 18A seems commensurate with that description of businesses. The other thing is that there is somewhat helpfully in the definition of large format retail a scale of activity in terms of GFA which relates to large format retail, which is 500 square metres. And I would suggest that, which is prohibited from the zone, based on its use.
Can you repeat that? Sorry, I didn't quite get that.
There is a definition of large format retail in Chapter 2 of the plan, which sets out that 500 square metres is a point at which large format retail qualifies, an activity that qualifies to be large format retail.
That's what large means.
Yeah. So I guess my point is that the generally enabling approach for up to 100 square metres, or it provides, the plan provides for that.
It's 50 to 100 is RDA, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
So 100 square metres would be 1/5 of that large format retail. So it provides a bit of guidance or perhaps a stake in the ground as to whether I consider ancillary activities should definitely go nowhere near. So there's a few things there to take into account.
If I may, sorry, is that not contrary to desires in our district and I think through the higher level policies to diversify our economy? Wouldn't we want to be promoting larger businesses that would require more staff and more office space and more in order to provide work opportunities in our district?
So the general industrial zone is the only zone in the district that enables industrial activities, and I would argue that it's possibly the most effective mechanism we've got to actually enable the diversification of the economy and the significant economic benefits that's going to provide. But
the bigger the industrial activity, the bigger the office space requirements, the bigger the ancillary requirements that are necessary. I mean, if there was a big producer of a manufacturer producer, you know, you take Calder Stewart for instance. I imagine that in Milton, I imagine that they employ more people than take up 50 or 100 square metres of, but also undertake a whole lot of production as well.
Yeah, potentially. However, those activities aren't common in our industrial economy.
But shouldn't they be? Shouldn't we be promoting them? Is my point.
Well, if they do want to locate within the zone, they are an industrial service activity, then there is a pathway for them to have larger ancillary activities. And I would argue that non-compliant activity status would.
Are they non-compliant or prohibited above?
No, it's non-compliant.
Above 100, okay.
It's not prohibited. So the Chapter 18A does provide a pathway for those activities you're describing, and I would imagine that wouldn't be an inappropriate activity if it was a true industrial service activity that was ancillary too.
I suppose that just leads to the question, is non-complying activity is status, is that encouraging that activity, or is it...
It's representing the fact that our industrial economy isn't commonly made up of those, and there will be only the exceptional cases in which that will likely to be the case.
Thank you. Commissioner Dawson.
My last question, it comes up in some of the sites, but it's a general question. There's a general rule, I presume, in the general industrial zone that about building restriction areas, that says you can't have any buildings or something like that. Mm. What do in terms of activities in the zone, what do BRAs do?
So BRAs...
What do they stop?
They just, it says no building shall be located within the building restriction area.
What number is that?
18A.4.3. It's under 18A.4.10. It's 18A4XX, but the numbering isn't provided.
Isn't that a standard? You put it in the activities list, just by the way.
In terms of the reference to no building shall occur.
Yeah, that's a standard, isn't it? It's not an activity rule.
I think it's the way that the plan has dealt with that.
You'd need to say any activity located within a building restriction area, NC. Not the way you've written it there. You've written it as a standard, but...
Potentially, but it's consistent with the plan.
Okay.
I believe.
All right. So any building located within a building restriction area is non-compliant. So it doesn't stop outdoor storage and vehicle parking and those sorts of activities.
The 18A.4.7 goes a bit further, talking to outdoor storage and outdoor waste storage within building restriction areas.
Oh, okay. So it does also have that rule. Outdoor storage, yeah. So that's the way you need to write the building one. Yes, so it does control outdoor storage, outdoor waste storage. And would outdoor storage include the parking of vehicles, like parking up all your big contractor equipment or whatever?
It would depend if that fits the definition of
outdoor
storage. If they were just...
It comes up at... site, like it's not necessarily being recommended to be a GIS anyway. Yes, it does say land storing vehicles and equipment and machinery. Yeah. All right. Thank you for that. I just wasn't sure what happened. That's all my questions. Thank you.
Thank you. I wonder if we take the morning to you, gentlemen, and come back and